Force Academy class of 79, Rhodes Scholar, All-American linebacker, Caltech PhD in computer science, combat fighter pilot, former commander of NORAD. The first black NSA director was a seriously formidable individual. He insisted that his staff address him by his fighter pilot handle, Balls, a play on the sports implication of his last name, reveling in the fact that it made some people uncomfortable. Denise was one of them. Still, she had to admit she liked the man. As far as she could tell, he sweated liquid charisma. Arrayed around the table were Levi Elias, generally regarded as the best intel analyst the NSA had, Dr. Bert Matthews, the computer scientist who had been chosen to fill Dr. Kurtz's shoes, and Carl Oberstein, the NSA's chief of operations.
"Okay, Denise, show us what you've got."
Nodding to the general, Denise picked up the remote control, pressed the green power button, and walked to the front of the room. The digital display that formed the entire wall came to life, its high-definition background image a lovely high-resolution shot of Earth from space. An image so crystal clear it had no counterpart in the civilian world, having been taken by one of the most sophisticated spy satellites ever created. If the satellite had been focused on the parking lot outside the Crystal Palace, not only could you have read the license plates, the multispectral imagery product could have told you how long the car had been parked there from the heat of the engines. It could have shown you which parking spots had been recently vacated from the differences in temperature of the ground that had been under the vehicles. Denise pressed a sequence of buttons on the remote, pulling up the presentation she had spent the last 2 hours preparing.
"Balls, gentlemen, I asked for this meeting to show you something that Big John brought to my attention this morning. The subject of the correlative data search was Jack the Ripper Gregory."
Seeing that she had their rapt attention, Denise flicked to the first slide. It showed the text message she'd received earlier in the day.
"I received this Big John alert shortly after noon today. What you need now is some context for the message so that you understand its importance. Several weeks ago, Big John began reporting a sequence of data correlations with the Gregory search, data points that by themselves seemed very tenuous."
Denise changed to a series of slides, showing what Big John had identified as connected events.
"I'll run through these quickly and then discuss the implied connections. The first of these events was the New Year's Day virus from a little over a year ago. The virus came to the NSA's attention for two reasons. It had the ability to encrypt data in a manner that our best methods couldn't break. It also revealed the location of a computer that held another encrypted message, this one breakable, with text that alluded to dangerous activity within the Los Alamos Row project. This was the event that caused Admiral Riles to send Jack Gregory's team to Los Alamos.
Next came an image showing Jack Gregory and Janet Price standing and cheering at a basketball game.
This was taken at the New Mexico State Championship basketball game that same year. I've circled in red the people occupying the seats next to Jack and Janet. They are, from left to right, Gil McFarland, Anna McFarland, Fred Smythe, Linda Smythe, Jennifer Smythe, and Heather McFarland. You'll recognize some of those names from my first slide. The other person mentioned in Big John's message today was Mark Smythe. He was a young all-state basketball player, playing in the state championship game."
Balls leaned forward.
"I remember reading about that kid. Fantastic young point guard, as I recall. ESPN was comparing him to a young Steve Nash."
Denise clicked to the next slide.
"This is an article that appeared in the Albuquerque Journal a short while later. A local EPA inspector named Jack Johnson, Gregory's cover name, had shown up at the Los Alamos hospital with an injured girl by the name of Heather McFarland. The story goes on to say that Jack apparently encountered a crazed homeless man who had been attempting to kidnap Heather McFarland. The two men fought, with Jack getting cut on the arm before the homeless man ran off. That man has never been seen again."
Balls laughed.
I'd say the chances of ever seeing him again aren't too good.
Carl Oberstein snorted in agreement.
Not much chance of that fellow surviving an encounter with Gregory. Surprises me he managed to cut him, though.
Probably had to do with protecting the girl, said Balls.
Here's another story from Los Alamos. Heather McFarland kidnapped and attacked by Dr. Ernesto Rodriguez, a top Roe Project scientist. He kills himself before arrest.
McFarland, kid? Kidnapped again?
Bert asked. Denise changed slides again.
This is from the Washington Post. It's the story about Jonathan Riles' murder of Dr. David Kurtz, after which he took his own life.
The atmosphere in the room acquired a somber cast.
This next slide is the AP story about the FBI attempt to capture or kill Jack Gregory and his team. Another black eye for the FBI folks, this one even surpassing Waco. A couple of Gregory's team killed, a couple dozen FBI agents and civilians killed. Jack and Janet escape.
Oberstein nodded.
I assume this is going somewhere?
Denise pursed her lips.
A few more minutes, and I'll put a bow around it for you.
Her curt response drew another chuckle from Balls Wilson.
Careful. She's got your number, Carl.
She began flipping through the slides more rapidly. The FBI director, murdered. President Harris, assassinated. Senator Pete Hornsby, the key Senate voice against the Roe Project, dead in a car accident, returning from his native Maine. The three McFarland kids win the National Science Fair with a cold fusion device, a prize that is stripped for plagiarism. Another AP story, this one about three missing Los Alamos, New Mexico high school students, Heather McFarland and Mark and Jennifer Smythe. Top CIA trainer, Garfield Cromley, found murdered. Then the body of Eduardo Montenegro, the assassin known as El Chupacabra, found at Shriver Air Force Base, not far from where Jack Gregory is known to have hijacked the satellite uplink, reprogramming global GPS satellites to shut down the Roe Project's nanite formula. Denise ended her slide presentation and faced the general. Big John has tagged every one of these events with a very high correlation to my Jack Gregory search query. Levi's nasal voice redirected her attention.
And what was Big John's calculated degree of correlation?
The worst correlation was 0.873.
That high?
Yes, and there's more. It turns out that Jennifer Smythe stayed several days at the Bellagio in Las Vegas, was identified by the security staff as a very accomplished hacker, and subsequently moved to the Espinosa Hacienda outside Medellin, Colombia. Not long after that, Don Espinosa and a number of his guards were killed. After that, Jennifer Smythe just disappeared.
What about the other two kids?
Nothing firm, but a member of Espinosa's cleaning staff reported seeing two young Americans arrive at the hacienda on the day that Don Espinosa died.
Jesus.
There's one more thing. That day was Thanksgiving here in the good old USA. The same day Jack Gregory killed the Espinosa cartel's number one hitman. The same day he reprogrammed the GPS satellites.
Denise paused.
Now we've learned that the FBI is set to monitor a computer chat session between the McFarland and Smythe kids and their parents tonight.
The room was silent for several seconds. Then General Balls Wilson rose to his feet.
Carl? I want that computer hacked, the computer that the FBI will be monitoring for tonight's chat. Work with Denise. Use her antivirus backdoor. Bottom line, I want us in virtual control of that system when tonight's chat session begins. Oh, and remember, that Smythe girl is supposed to be a talented hacker. Keep our data copy local. Nothing goes out on the net while the chat session is in progress.
But what about the FBI? Aren't they going to grab that computer right after the session?
Not likely. It would be a dead giveaway to their quarry. They'll remain in stakeout mode.
Okay. You've got it, boss.
Make damn sure I do.
Then the general turned on his heel and was gone. Chapter 33. Mark watched Heather's eyes go white, then brown, then white again, changing color so rapidly he could almost convince himself that he'd imagined it. But he hadn't. She shuddered, shook her head, and grimaced.
Screw it!
What? Mark asked, taken aback by Heather's unusual descent into vulgarity. Her angry eyes centered on his.
Sometimes I make myself so mad I can't stand it. In a few minutes, we're going to get a chance to chat with our parents, something I want so bad I can taste it, and all I can do is second-guess our decision.
Understandable, said Mark.
Bullshit! If we can't trust our parents, whom can we trust?
Mark paused for several seconds. True enough, but we know that both our houses were bugged by Jack and Janet. Who's to say those bugs aren't still active? Much to Mark's relief, Heather nodded and calmed down.
That must be it. What's been worrying me, I mean.
We've taken appropriate precautions, made a backdrop for our camera position with plastic sheeting, dressed ourselves in these white sheet togas. As long as we stay focused on not revealing anything about where we are and remember we might be monitored, we'll be fine. It's impossible to trace our subspace signal. Heather's eyes momentarily faded to gray, staying that way just long enough to concern Mark before they refocused.
You're right. No reason to worry.
Just then, Jennifer entered the lab, the outside door letting in a breath of summer night air, thick with humidity and smells that signaled the gathering storm. Her eyes swept across them.
You guys all right?
Fine, said Heather, putting on what Mark knew was a forced smile.
Just a little anxious.
Jen smiled back at her.
No kidding, me too.
Sitting down at her laptop, Jennifer logged in, then engaged the program that would connect them to Linda Smythe's laptop. Her middle finger paused just above the enter key.
Well, here goes.
She tapped the key, activating the subspace transmission. Nothing happened for several seconds. Then a video window filled the screen. There in front of them were the visages of their parents, crowded together in front of the computer camera. Sadness engulfed Mark as he saw the tears streaming down Heather's face. She still managed to be first to speak.
Hi, Mom. Dad. I miss you so much.
We miss you too, baby.
Mr. McFarlane's voice brought a rush of memories to Mark. Memories centered in more comfortable times. Better days from the past. Mrs. McFarlane stared into the screen, eyes misted, rendered completely speechless. Then everyone spoke in a rush, Mark, Jen, and Heather competing for airtime, even as all of the parents stepped all over each other's words on the far end. The expressions of love gave way to questions about how each of them was doing. Gradually, talk shifted to questions about their situation. Where were they? Did they need help? Could they come home? Although they'd talked through these likely questions, Mark found them difficult to answer. With every question they dodged, their parents pressed for more details. If they needed help, they would get it. If someone was holding them against their will, just list the demands. Everything could be made all right again. Home was still home. Then, seemingly before they'd even started the conversation, the wall clock indicated the time they'd agreed on had expired, and Mark found himself taking the lead and telling his mom and dad goodbye. Another round of tears from the girls and their moms, another round of sad goodbyes from their dads, and then Jennifer terminated the session. Jennifer leaned forward on the desk, elbows on the table, face in her hands. Heather's white eyes seemed to stare right through him, tears cutting narrow trails down her cheeks. As Mark stared down at the blank computer screen, the distant rumble of thunder marred the silence that had descended on the computer lab.
standing there next to Heather and Jennifer, listening to the gathering storm. He couldn't remember ever having been so depressed. Fred Smythe put his arms around his wife, pulling her into a bear hug that was joined by Gil and Anna, a tiny huddle sharing the most difficult game of their lives. When he finally released her, he smiled.
"Darling, why don't you take Anna and Gil down to the kitchen and put on a pot of tea? I'll shut down your computer and be right down."
Linda glanced at Anna, nodded, and led the other two out into the hallway and down the stairs. Fred steadied himself, took in a great gulping breath, and took a seat in front of the laptop. Reaching under the table, he removed the listening device the FBI field agent had given him earlier in the day. Shoving it into his pocket, Fred grabbed the mouse, clicked the start button, selected shutdown, and waited. After several seconds, a new window appeared on the laptop. "Please do not power off or unplug your machine. Installing update 1 of 2. Fred shook his head. Damned Microsoft automatic updates. He'd have to remember to disable those next time he logged on to Linda's computer. Rising to his feet, he walked out of the room. Time to go visit with Linda and his friends, to spend some time talking about their kids. And as bad as the situation seemed, their kids were still alive. That certainly made the world feel a whole lot more manageable than it had just 2 days ago. That damn laptop could take its sweet time shutting down. Balls Wilson leaned over Dr. Matthews's shoulder, his eyes scanning the rapidly scrolling computer screen.
"So, Bert, did we get the data dump or not?"
"Don't worry, sir. It's streaming in right now."
Chapter 34.
Dr. Donald Stevenson stared out at his audience, his eyes sweeping across the seated assemblage. The auditorium was completely full, 1,800 scientists shifting uneasily in their seats, staring up at him as if he were the Antichrist, hated but too frightening to ignore. As Dr. Stevenson watched them watch him, feeling their emotion radiating out, he smiled inwardly. "That which you don't understand, you fear. That which you fear, you hate." Dr. Stevenson understood that feeling and relished it. During his humiliating stint in prison, he had made those sentences his mantra. If his warped childhood had taught him anything, it was an abhorrence of imprisonment. It didn't really matter whether it was in a bedroom closet or an 8-by-12-foot steel-barred cell. For a moment, he wanted nothing more than to make every person in the audience experience what he had had to experience. But it would have been lost on them. For one thing, he was a genius, while most of them were morons. It was hard to make a moron understand anything, even with a tactile demonstration. He realized all of a sudden that they were waiting for him to speak, that in a few more moments he would have introduced what might be called an awkward silence. Dr. Stevenson cleared his throat.
"Fellow scientists, distinguished guests, it is truly an honor to stand before you on this momentous day, a day that represents the dawning of a new age for humanity."
A soft muttering swept through the crowd, like a soft wind stirring autumn leaves.
"Let me be clear," Dr. Stevenson's amplified voice echoed through the auditorium. "Our world hangs in the balance. At this moment, an unstable anomaly lies at the heart of the Atlas detector, spiraling inexorably out of our control, spiraling toward the end of all we know, toward the end of this fragile existence we treasure."
He paused to let his words take effect, already beginning to treasure their frightened reaction.
"This anomaly, this horrible thing, cannot be slowed. It cannot be stopped.
In 9 months, 13 days, 4 hours, and 32 minutes, it will become a black hole, and there is nothing anyone in this world or the next can do to stop that from happening." A low moan arose from the audience, an ethereal entity that coalesced into physical form. Dread incarnate. Just as satisfying as he had thought it would be. Now, time to play the hero. "Take heart," Dr. Stevenson smiled, his thin lips curling reluctantly upward. "Humankind is not yet lost. While my calculations show that the anomaly cannot be stopped, it doesn't have to happen here. Not on planet Earth."
"And how is that?"
The voice of Dr. Kai Waller rang out through the auditorium. "Thank you for that question, Dr. Waller." "Yes, thank you for those 4 words, Doctor. So artfully phrased, so erudite. As you all know, my background for the last couple of decades has revolved around the study of alien technologies under what has been dubbed the Roe Project. As a result of that study, the American government has spawned 2 minor technological initiatives. The first of these was the Cold Fusion Initiative, the second being the nanotech formula that shows great promise in eradicating all forms of human disease, potentially extending the human lifespan to hundreds of years. Notice that I referred to each of these revolutionary technologies as minor advancements. That is because I have uncovered something on the alien spacecraft that contains far more potential benefit to humanity. In our current predicament, it offers hope where otherwise none should lie. Dr. Stevenson inhaled deeply, letting the still air of the Swiss auditorium infuse his lungs as he strolled across the stage, wireless microphone clutched firmly in his left hand. His audience had gone completely silent, an aura of expectancy hovering about them. He wouldn't make them wait for long. "What we will now commence is a project of epic proportions, a project to save our planet from complete and utter destruction. If any of you doubt the cost of doing nothing, I will be happy to share my analysis of the data for peer review." Dr. Stevenson made sure that his smile left little doubt that he found the idea that he had any peers in this group comical. Then, as if a cloud had passed in front of the sun, Stevenson's brow darkened again. He was, after all, a mercurial god. "Let me be clear. We have but one chance to save our world. If the anomaly cannot be stopped, and it can't, the black hole must happen elsewhere. In order for that to occur, we must build a machine capable of generating a wormhole that will transport the anomaly into empty space, far from our solar system." The room erupted into bedlam. Scientists talking over other scientists, their feeble efforts effectively drowning each other out. Dr. Peter Voice, an angular Dutch physicist, stood on his chair so that he rose above his compatriots. "What Dr. Stevenson proposes is madness. Even if we take him at his word that he understands this alien technology, it is still madness. Creating a wormhole here on Earth could set in motion an incalculable sequence of events, possibly even a cataclysm worse than what it is designed to cure." Voice was the kind of Dutchman who'd stand there with his finger in a dike all afternoon long, refusing to recognize that everything was crumbling around him. "Would someone please help Dr. Voice contain his emotions?" Dr. Stevenson's voice dripped contempt. "Clearly they have colored his reasoning so that logic is no longer an option. In his world, a black hole consuming our entire planet is less dangerous than attempting to create a wormhole to transport the anomaly into empty space. Dr. Foyce's face turned red on its way to purple.
There are other options!
Enlighten me. We could launch the anomaly into space. Dr. Stevenson laughed. Once again, Foyce hadn't failed to disappoint. Could we? The only thing keeping the anomaly from becoming a black hole is the magnetic containment field and the most perfect vacuum chamber we've been able to create. That would have to be maintained throughout the launch. To do that, we would have to build a very large launch vehicle around it, right here in this cavern. Probably something like the Saturn V. Assuming we could do that, the containment apparatus would have to also have its power supply transported with it. By the way, it's not good enough to just launch the space vehicle out of Earth orbit. At some point, the power and therefore the containment field would fail, and the anomaly would eat its spacecraft. Then it would continue to travel within our solar system, its event horizon expanding with every bit of matter ingested, a growing black hole beyond anyone's power to stop. Assuming the containment field could survive the trip. If you think the anomaly will remain stable long enough to exit our solar system with all the gravitational slingshots that such a trip requires, you aren't qualified to be in this room. Dr. Stevenson paused, his eyes once again scanning his audience. Someone said there are no stupid questions. It should be plain to everyone in attendance that Dr. Foyce has just disproved that assertion. In fact, the person who made that assertion is clearly a moron. I don't expect anyone in here to like me. I don't want your adoration. But I do demand your attention. I've arranged for a copy of my proposal to be placed on each of your desktops, ready for your perusal upon your return to your offices. I recommend you take a long, hard look at that material as soon as you depart this auditorium. Dr. Stevenson walked to the podium, swept the space with his lifeless gaze one last time, then set the mic on the lectern, turned, and walked off stage.
Chapter 35. Kai Wohler watched Donald Stevenson walk off the stage as the auditorium erupted around him. Everyone seemed to be talking at once. It was like an American sports bar on Super Bowl afternoon. During those endless hours before the game when sportscasters droned on and on with pre-game minutiae. As the fans drained mug after mug of draft beer, the volume of conversation varied inversely with sobriety. Reaching for his cell phone, Dr. Wohler suddenly remembered he didn't have it. This was a classified building. Thus he, and every other member of the audience, had dropped cell phones and other such devices in rows of small lockers outside. One thing for certain, security or no, as soon as this crowd exited the building, the secrecy surrounding this anomaly was coming off. Now that this many people knew that Dr. Stevenson regarded the black hole as a certainty, it would be minutes, not hours, before word leaked to the press. Before that happened, Kai would break the news to his beloved Karina, more gently than she would get it from TV's breathless talking heads. Trying to make his way to the aisle, he found himself crammed between people, unable to move. Apparently there was some sort of jam-up at the top of the steps leading to the auditorium exit. Suddenly the microphone squealed, then several loud puffs of breath echoed through the speakers as someone blew into it. Kai turned to see Dr. Louis Dubois standing at the lectern, microphone in hand.
Attention, please! Everyone! Can I have your attention?
All heads spun to look at the respected scientist,
former chief of the Atlas Project.
May I please have some quiet?
Dr. Dubois lowered his voice slightly, the effect silencing the auditorium.
I'm afraid I have an announcement that will be a bit disruptive to your schedules. Due to the sensitive nature of the information you have just received, we have assigned you all temporary cubicle office space within this building where you will work until we have all finished our review of Dr. Stevenson's analysis and recommendations.
The crowd volume bubbled up again, but Dr. Dubois continued.
By order of the leaders of the European Union, in agreement with the United States government, this facility is on lockdown until our task is completed and government leaders have made a decision. NATO military forces have completely secured the perimeter, and no one will be allowed to enter or leave any LHC area until further notice. You should know that a news story has just been released stating that the LHC has suffered a toxic containment breach and has been quarantined until the situation has been resolved. Nearby communities are being evacuated as I speak.
Once again, the crowd raised its confused voices, causing Dr. Dubois to speak louder.
As you are released from this auditorium, you will be given a package specifying your cubicle number as well as a building map to help you find it. Please report to your cube as soon as possible. There you will find a complete copy of the material Dr. Stevenson has provided. In addition, each cubicle has its own laptop, connected to our internal classified network for your work, but there is no external internet connection. Along one side of your cubicles, you will find a cot and a small bag of assorted toiletries. Shower facilities are available on each floor and are marked on your building map, along with restrooms and fully stocked break rooms. Most of you are already familiar with our first floor cafeteria.
Dr. Dubois paused, letting the room settle into a stunned silence.
Despite what Dr. Stevenson said, I have worked with most of you for years, and I know you to be the best of the best. The sooner we finish this task, the sooner we will get to go home to see our loved ones. The sooner we would be able to begin the work to save our planet. Now, make me proud.
Then, Dr. Dubois turned and walked off the stage, heading in the opposite direction from that taken by Dr. Stevenson.
Chapter 36. Having made the tough decision, Mark led Heather and Jen up onto the porch for their daily pre-dawn briefing with Jack and Janet. The cool morning air had an extra bite to it. The first hint of Bolivian winter, just enough to raise the goose flesh on his bare arms. Jack stood watching them come, a steaming mug of coffee in his hand. On the table in front of Janet, the pot sat invitingly close to three more brown ceramic mugs. Mark filled all three mugs, then lifted his slowly to his lips as he straightened. The aroma matched the hot liquid's taste, strong but smooth. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, then turned to face their trainers.
"We've got something to tell you."
"I'm listening."
Jack's eyes narrowed ever so slightly. Mark didn't take that as a good sign.
"Last night we contacted our folks via a subspace video chat link."
Neither Jack nor Janet showed any sign of surprise, nor did they speak, letting the silence hang heavy. Mark was relieved when Heather's steady voice filled the vacuum.
"We didn't ask permission, and we don't make any excuses for what we did. We knew the risk, but we did it anyway."
"We know we put you in danger, too," Mark said, trying to give Heather some cover. "But that doesn't mean we regret it."
Once again, the silence descended, finally broken by Jack.
"Can't say I'm surprised. Janet and I knew you'd make that call sooner or later.
We had a small wager about when it would happen.
Mark didn't know whether to be irritated that they were so predictable or happy that they'd avoided a reprimand. A hint of a smile creased the corners of Janet's mouth.
I won. Jack didn't really think you'd last this long.
Of course he hadn't, and he'd almost been right. So, Jack said, finish off your coffee, grab a bite to eat from the kitchen, and get ready. You've got a full schedule today.
And what if they find a way to trace us? Mark asked.
Jack shrugged. I assume you took the proper precautions. Besides, the only thing you can be sure of in this life is that sooner or later everything goes wrong. Whether because of this or something else, they will eventually find us. It's why we constantly rehearse our reaction drills.
I don't know why they have to find us, said Jennifer. Lots of criminals and terrorists have managed to stay below the radar.
Apples and oranges, Jack replied.
There are two kinds of people in this world, sheep and wolves. The politicians who lie hidden in holes aren't wolves. They're sheep, sending their wolves out to make things happen. Janet and I are wolves. It's what we've trained you to be.
Janet glanced at her watch.
You three better hustle. You've only got 8 minutes to scarf down some breakfast before we hit the firing range. Today you get to shoot the 50-caliber sniper rifles and M2 machine guns. Anyone who outshoots me gets out of ammo reload duty.
Mark rolled his eyes. Just because their schedule was so tough didn't mean it couldn't get tougher. Maybe they hadn't avoided punishment after all.
Chapter 37 Levi Elias hadn't gotten his reputation for being the best analyst the NSA had for nothing. Sitting in his boss's office, James Blanchard watched as Levi leveled his gaze at him, his dark eyes like the twin barrels of a 12-gauge shotgun.
Tell me what we got.
A hell of a lot more than the FBI, James grinned.
Explain.
Just like us, they put a sniffer on the IP traffic coming in through the network card. Funny thing is, not a damned thing came in through the network interface.
And?
And thank God for Denise's Puff the Magic Dragon code in the laptop's antivirus software. It recorded every bit and byte of data that changed on the laptop during the visual chat session, including sound and video.
Nothing came through the network card? How's that possible?
It's not. At least not with any technology we know about. But it fits with some of the stuff that caused Admiral Riles to send Jack Gregory's team to Los Alamos.
So what do you make of it?
James Blanchard looked at Levi Elias and shrugged.
I've been with my team all night, and most of this morning going over the recorded audio and video streams at least 24 times. Bottom line, boss, we've got nothing.
Nothing?
Whoever these kids are, they're good.
James worked the jog shuttle, moving the recording forward 5 minutes.
Typical example, background is draped by thick plastic sheeting, common contractor material, made by hundreds of companies all over the world, mostly in Asia, my guess China.
James zoomed in on a small section of the plastic, a tight shot that eliminated the foreground. He swirled a small circle with his laser pointer's red dot.
You can see small beads of condensation on the plastic. Cool room, high humidity. This time of year you get those conditions in an air-conditioned room on about 37% of the planet, including the entire U.S. Gulf Coast.
He backed out of the zoom, selected a control on the electronic light table, and quickly drew a dotted outline around each of the young people in the frozen image. Another tool click, and Heather McFarland, Mark Smythe, and Jennifer Smythe came up in their own frame, the sheet having been cropped out of the image so they were displayed against a pure white background.
Notice anything peculiar about these three?
Nice hands, muscular, taut faces. Just glancing at them, I'd say they've been on a 3-month vacation at a health spa. Either that or training for the Olympic beach volleyball team. What's that they're wearing? Togas?
Sheets.
Sheets?
Sure as shit. Plain old cotton bed sheets.
Let me guess. Kind you can buy anywhere, probably made in China. Looks like they were expecting to have their chat session intercepted.
As generic as it gets.
Give me a tight shot of each face, side by side. Keep the rest of the background clipped out. Then let the video roll.
James Blanchard made the adjustments and started the video from the beginning. The display filled with three faces. The enhanced video so clear that Levi could see the moisture glisten on their teeth as they smiled.
Amp up the audio.
The audio volume rose until he could feel the vibration of the bass notes in Mark's voice.
Pause that.
The video froze. The sound stopped.
What did the voice stress analysis show? Are they under duress?
Inconclusive. There's stress there, but it seems to be closely associated with the emotions of talking with parents they've been missing. I'd say they want to come home, but can't. Lots of reasons for that, though. Doesn't mean they're being held against their will. Once more, I go back to their physical appearance. That kind of muscle tone doesn't square with being held captive. Neither does the tan.
Let the video roll again.
The booming volume filled the room as Levi watched the facial expressions that went with the audio. Suddenly he sat up.
Stop. Replay the last 15 seconds. 5% more volume. There. You hear something?
James nodded.
Replay it again, but mask out all the voices. I only want background noises.
This time it took Blanchard 15 minutes to manipulate the sound editor to achieve the desired effect. When he played the audio again, a number of noises stood out. The sound of computer fans, the AC electric current humming in the lights, and 4 seconds of a chirping noise.
Was that a bird?
Yes, sir. Definitely a bird sound.
What kind?
Blanchard laughed.
Not my specialty.
Levi didn't laugh.
Then find someone whose specialty it is. I want to know exactly what kind of a bird that was, where it lives, its migratory patterns, and what color seeds it shits. One more thing. I want your team to reanalyze the whole thing. Background noises only. Identify any animal or insect sounds. Same drill as the bird.
As Blanchard began moving toward the door, Levi called after him.
Oh, and James, get someone working on that AC electrical hum. I want to know if it's 50 or 60 hertz.
I'm on it.
Moving down the hallway at a brisk walk, James smiled. If he had to work for an analyst, it felt good to work for the best in the business.
Chapter 38.
President Jackson sat with his back to the towering windows, gold curtains pulled tightly closed, with only the wall-mounted candelabras adorning the cream-colored slices of wall that separated them. He glanced around at his national security staff, seated in the burgundy leather chairs around the great table that filled the bulk of the White House cabinet room. Today's meeting only involved the central core of the NSS. Vice President Bob Bethard, Secretary of State Beth McKee, Secretary of Defense Gary Blake, Director of National Intelligence Corey Mayfield, National Security Advisor James Nobles, Director of Homeland Security Thane Evans, and the President's Chief of Staff Carol Owens. In addition to the core team, Carl Reiner, the Director of Central Intelligence, occupied a seat to the President's left. It was going to be his show. Just a couple of hours earlier, Reiner had informed the president that President Chekhov of the Russian Federation, in a surprise move, had held a hastily assembled press conference to announce that Russia had developed its own version of the nanite serum. The president's first response had been unprintable, but Reiner had had worse news.
Apparently, they're set to begin mass production at several manufacturing facilities.
They've already begun inoculating military personnel and plan to roll it out for the general population over the coming months, before making it available for sale on the international market.
It was why he'd now assembled the whole National Security Brain Trust. President Jackson spread his hands in a gesture of inclusiveness.
Well, I guess we're all in. The Chinese, French, and others can't be far behind the Russians. The real question is, what are we going to do in response? Before I hear your thoughts, I've asked the DCI to give us a quick rundown from the CIA point of view.
All eyes turned toward the CIA director.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Carl Reiner opened a leather portfolio, moving its contents into three small stacks in front of him.
I'll start with the nanite situation, since that is the most directly affected by President Chekhov's announcement.
The president hoped this presentation wouldn't be as grim as he expected.
As you all know, Central Intelligence has focused a large effort these last several months toward analyzing the consequences of our own nanite formula rollout, starting with the African continent, since they had already received the initial distribution. The results of that initial distribution are a mixed bag, mostly bad. In countries decimated by AIDS, malnutrition, and other diseases, it is hardly surprising that desperation for a cure has led to fighting between those who received the first doses and those who had to wait. Violent gangs began kidnapping nanite recipients, bleeding them into plasma bags for resale, along with acts of superstitious barbarism. While Jack Gregory's GPS broadcast shut down most of those nanites, there were significant numbers of people that were shielded from that signal, and they still have active nano-serum in their blood. I don't need to tell you the jeopardy in which they've found themselves. Most of them tried, with varying degrees of success, to pretend their nanites were deactivated like all the rest, but it only takes one public injury to put the lie to those pretenses. Mix that with gangs of nanite-augmented young men, drunk with the power of virtual invulnerability, and you get the effect we're seeing on African societies. A drastic increase in tribalism. By this, I mean that groups have grown more homogeneous, either for protection or for aggression. I won't belabor the details, but this analysis, combined with worries about the possible long-term negative impact of nanite dependence on people's natural immune systems, has led to the president's meticulously planned nanite redistribution. Although we all knew that the day would come when other governments were able to duplicate the formula, I think we all hoped we'd have time to test our delivery strategy first, establishing a measure of control over these types of negative consequences. That's no longer an option.
So, what do you recommend we do about it?
President Jackson's lips had tightened into a thin line during Reiner's summary. He sensed that, unfortunately, Reiner had saved the worst news for last.
Before I give you my recommendation, I need to reference two other areas that critically impact the situation.
Carl Reiner spread several papers from his second stack across the table in front of him.
The first is the other alien technology that was released to the public, cold fusion. Although it's been widely hailed as a home run for our planet, it carries parallel dangers. Every scientist and energy expert I've talked to has been stunned with the speed with which industry has implemented increasingly efficient versions of this technology, dropping the price to where it will soon be available to power automobiles. Machinery that uses fossil fuels is about to become as outdated as the ancient plants and animals that compose those fuels. It has happened so fast that OPEC finds itself with its monetary spigot rotating into the off position. Islamic radicalism is ramping up with the rise in Muslim rage and frustration. Since Islam is composed of a number of sects, primarily Sunni and Shiite, they are being driven into the same tight tribal groupings. It's reached the point that regional war is a near-term certainty.
Reiner paused to let his words take effect. Everyone in this room had already known this information, but the silence and grim expressions indicated that his words had driven it home like a stake in the heart.
We've seen the same type of radicalization taking hold here at home, Thane Evans interrupted, starting with a lot of militia folks in the Northwest and South, even spreading to groups like the Sierra Club. Hell, Native American tribes are going off the energy grid at a pace that indicates they're working from a central playbook. As the buzz in the room started to rise, President Jackson held up a hand, immediately quieting the gathered officials.
Let Carl finish. Then we'll all get a chance at this.
And they would, too. He'd work them half to death if he had to. This was too important. Reiner continued as if the interruption hadn't happened.
That brings me to the ultimate point. The executioner's axe hanging over this planet in Switzerland. Mr. President, as soon as you and our allies in Europe make the joint announcement that a black hole is forming at the heart of the LHC, these global and local pressures are going to explode. It's a miracle that the secrecy around the November anomaly has held up this long, but that can only last a couple more weeks. As soon as the world's richest nations start building Dr. Stevenson's monstrous new row project device, there won't be any more denying the scope of our problem. 2 weeks, tops. That's what we've got to get a plan put together and coordinated with our major allies. In order of priority, we need a plan to protect this new Stevenson Row project, a plan to protect our government and key population centers, a plan to gradually reestablish order where we aren't able to maintain it initially, and a plan to keep our enemies from blowing us to hell before we can get all those other things done. Reiner replaced the stacks of notes to which he'd been referring in the leather portfolio and closed it. Mr. President, that's how the CIA sees the world situation.
The president took a long, slow drink from the Waterford crystal glass at his elbow. He nodded at Reiner.
Thanks, Carl. Excellent rundown.
President Jackson had once heard a quote from one of the helicopter pilots who had flown special forces into Afghanistan through thick mountain fog. After returning from the mission when his colonel asked him how he felt, the pilot had responded that he couldn't drive a toothpick up his ass with a jackhammer. It pretty accurately described the president's own feelings at this moment. Turning his attention to his chief of staff, President Jackson said,
Carol, how about sticking your head out and getting someone to round us up some pizzas? Looks like it's going to be a long night.
Chapter 39
Heather slid the alien headset over her temples, feeling the warmth of its massaging pulse slide through her brain. Sitting together with her in a loose triangle on the Fraser veranda, Mark and Jennifer echoed her action. Cloaked in twilight shadows, Jack leaned back in his own chair, his booted feet propped on a coffee table as he watched them. No pressure. Heather entered the bandolier ship's computer on point, Jennifer following her lead as Mark took up a virtual overwatch position, alert for any sign of the artificial intelligence that had attacked them on their last visit. Heather calculated the odds of another hostile encounter with the AI at less than 7.3642%, but that was still a long way from zero. The announcement from Russia that it had already begun inoculating Russian soldiers with its own nanite formula hadn't come as a great surprise, but it had narrowed their timeline. Another sign that training days here at the Fraser Hacienda were rapidly coming to an end. Despite their best efforts, the nanite genie was now out of the bottle for good. Earth's population was going to have to learn to come to terms with that new reality, or face a very bitter future. Of greater concern was what they had discovered about Dr. Stevenson's activities at the Large Hadron Collider. So far, the governments of the United States and the European Union had managed to keep a lid on that secret, but that wouldn't last much longer. Heather didn't care to think about what was likely to happen as soon as the world learned about the November anomaly. Her visions hadn't left her with a warm, cozy feeling on that one. Returning to the matter at hand, Heather traversed the fractal data map with a speed that defied its incredible complexity, ignoring data paths that offered stunning revelations in physics and mathematics, despite their strong tugs on her curiosity.
She knew what she was after, and it was critical that she maintain a tight focus on that mission. Within 5 minutes, Heather identified a key nexus, a point at which several related paths branched. A shared thought released Jennifer along one of those paths as Heather's mind opened itself to another. The world she had known melted away as she found herself hurled from the Milky Way's familiar spiral arm. A third of the way toward the galaxy's core, she swept toward the fifth planet of 18 that circled a dull orange star. The planet was a gas giant twice Jupiter's size, one of its 13 moons slightly larger than Earth. Her view shifted, swooping in on the moon, decelerating until she hung above it like a high-performance reconnaissance drone. That wasn't quite right. She found she could spin the globe in any direction, although what was really happening was a repositioning of her virtual camera location. For several seconds, she found herself so fascinated by the amazing control she enjoyed over the system that she failed to recognize the significance of the scene unfolding below her. 48% of the moon's surface was covered in water, the rest occupied by 5 continents, each considerably larger than Asia. Tied into the computer as deeply as she now was, Heather merely had to think about a topic, and her brain immediately found itself immersed in relevant data. Some things, like the names assigned to this particular solar system and its planets, were merely lengthy alphanumeric representations that, although useful for cataloging, didn't exactly roll off the tongue. Heather decided to assign the huge gas giant the name Jupiter II, tagging its populated moon as Zeta. Zeta's atmosphere was an oxygen-nitrogen mixture, although the increased oxygen content and atmospheric density would have given humans a continuous high. The oceans teemed with sea life, although very few species bore any resemblance to fish, the majority looking much more like some of the odd creatures found at extreme depths in Earth's oceans. But it was something else entirely that took Heather aback. The land masses were covered in cityscapes, advanced so far beyond Earth technology that they looked more like CPUs viewed through an electron microscope. The continent cities teemed with activity, although little ground space had been allocated to vehicular traffic. Vehicles moved up and through the air to their appointed destinations. The indigenous population was an amalgam of species, varied in physical form, but working in a unison that implied shared thoughts, vaguely resembling the kind of mental sharing that she, Mark, and Jennifer experienced through the alien headsets. Her mental link to the bandolier ship's computer supplied a name. The Kasari Collective. Another oddity attracted her attention. The vast majority of the people on this planet were soldiers, perhaps all of them. Unlike the military organizations of Earth, in which the soldiers were backed by huge logistics tails, this organizational structure seemed to be mostly composed of teeth. The beans and bullets part of the operation was supported mostly by autonomous machines that delivered what was needed at the specified place and time. Although these beings tended to be larger than humans, many of the species looked distinctly humanoid, walking upright on 2 legs, some with multiple pairs of arms. Everywhere she looked, Heather observed males and females of military age. Clearly, the actual ages of these people differed from Earth ages by a factor of several lifetimes, but she had expected to observe children and the aged. But there just weren't any. Not on Zeta. Not one sentient being on this Earth-sized moon with its population of 18 billion actually came from Zeta. The entire moon was nothing but a giant interconnected hub of military bases, one of many worlds that served a similar purpose for the Kasari. Each base formed a wheel around a central debarkation center, manned to maintain readiness for the moment when that particular center would go active. From an engineering perspective, it was an extremely effective system. Heather was reminded of one of her history lessons. In Israel, the once mighty fortress of Masada sits atop an escarpment, its walls dropping away in sheer cliffs. In Roman times, it was stocked with years of supplies, absolutely impregnable. but the Romans crushed Masada in typical Roman fashion by applying an engineering solution. They built a huge ramp to the top of the cliff walls and used human shields from the local population to stop the defenders from raining down arrows and hot oil, using the resulting road to overwhelm their enemies in the castle. The Kasari seemed to be familiar with similar modes of military thought. Of course, even the mighty Romans had ultimately been defeated. Heather shifted her virtual position to inside the massive central facility at one of these hubs. A huge machine occupied the center of the stadium-sized room, a great ring structure that rose up like a mighty wheel, a gateway. The technology that made the gateways possible was uniquely that of the Kasari. It was their strength, but it was also their weakness. To generate gravitational forces great enough to form wormhole gateways required extraordinary matter-to-energy conversion, the process consuming resources on a scale that bled planetary systems dry in just a few hundred years. That was problem number one. The second problem was that no one had ever come up with a solution that allowed a wormhole spawned from just one gateway to be stable enough to allow a living being to survive the trip through it. To damp the inertial forces enough for someone to survive the trip, you needed a gateway at each end. Once again, the Kasari had come up with an engineering solution. Find a world with intelligent life that had acquired nuclear technology. Then, send a robot ship through a one-ended wormhole to seduce its population with the offer of wondrous technologies, the ultimate being the construction of a gateway. Once the gateway was complete and came online, the Kasari would connect a matching gateway, and the waiting army would pour through. But the system wasn't perfect. Many of the robot ships were destroyed by the bandolier ships makers, the Altrians, another name supplied by her newfound computer access. Some worlds never succumbed to the technological temptations provided by the robot ships. Even in the best scenario, large numbers of soldiers had to be kept at the ready for many years as they waited for the far gate to activate. But when it did activate, there was no stopping the invading Kasari force. They poured through, securing the immediate area around the far gateway, methodically extending their control until another world's population had been absorbed into the collective. On the other hand, the Altrians had advanced technologies of their own, including a mastery of subspace that allowed faster-than-light transport of their own starships, and these could carry living crews. But starships were expensive things and couldn't compete with gateways when it came to rapidly moving large numbers of soldiers to new worlds. And though the Altrians experienced frequent victories, every loss extended the Kasari Empire. The Kasari had been spreading for centuries, with no sign of slowing down. As Heather stared at the alien soldiers going about their tasks near the dormant gateway, she suddenly froze. She knew what Dr. Stevenson was up to in Switzerland. Suddenly, the prospect of a world overrun with nanites seemed the least of their worries. Chapter 40.
"We've got them."
General Wilson looked up to see a rare smile on Levi Elias's narrow face.
"Tell me."
"It was the bird, all right. Saltators amillis, a species of cardinal indigenous to the hill country bordering the southern Amazon, specifically parts of Paraguay, Uruguay, and northeastern Bolivia. Also, the electrical hum from the lights was 50 hertz, so that matches."
"Pretty big area."
"Yes, it is. So we did a check against any of Jack Gregory's previous assignments."
"And?"
"Several years ago, Gregory was assigned to eliminate a threat against Miguel de Escuela, a senior Bolivian politician on the CIA's payroll. A communist guerrilla leader had placed a contract on de Escuela. Gregory eliminated the threat."
"Did he have direct contact with de Escuela?"
"He did. After assassinating the guerrilla warlord, the Ripper killed two hitmen inside de Escuela's house. saved the politician, his wife, and 4 children.
A man in Gregory's debt.
Indeed. But there's no record of any subsequent contact between them. We actually looked at this potential linkage several months ago, but came up dry. However, with this latest information, we had Big John take another look. Levi handed Balls Wilson a folder containing 6 satellite images. The general spread them across his desktop. It's a ranch about an hour out of San Javier, formerly the property of Nuremberg trial fugitive and former SS officer Jori Klaus. Turns out that Miguel de Escuela was instrumental in confiscating that property after Klaus's death, then arranging its transfer to another German, one Carl Jacques Frazier.
You've confirmed it's Gregory?
There's no photo of Frazier on file. Bolivia isn't really at the top of the food chain in maintaining digitized records, but Big John thinks it's him. Correlation 0.803.
Balls Wilson studied the photographs more intensely. These aren't very good.
No. We don't have any of our better spy satellites on an orbit that covers Bolivia. These are the best.